Morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today's program is essentially a commemoration of a fabled woodsman and of a mariner who died at sea. I begin with QB Zeke. It has been 30 years since Bob Zeke died in the summer of 1990 at age 73. He was universally known as QB because, according to legend, a cowlick of hair stuck up from his head when he was born or just thereafter. Studs Terkel interviewed QB in 1980, 10 years before QB's death. The interview appeared in Terkel's book, American Dreams, Lost and Found, published in 1981 by Pantheon Books. QB Zeke was born in 1917 and fought in World War II in the Philippines and other places in the Pacific. He was a rare and singular man. He was inspiringly eloquent with a good-humored lilt to his deep, chested, docile voice. He could be as scathing or as oratorical as an old Roman senator. He was a man of the woods who was legendary for his courage and protection of wildlife. He created a sanctuary for birds and animals along the Columbia River and risked his life to defend eagles and their nest trees, almost single-handedly forcing timber companies to stop cutting the trees. He protected salmon spawning grounds from the depredations of a mining company and helped stop construction of an aluminum smelter that would grossly polluted the lower Columbia estuary. He hunted bear hunters with his fists and guns. He was nationally known as the environmentalist logger for his practice of sustainable logging and reforesting timber on his land near Napa. He thought in terms of centuries, expressed through the cycles of his beloved forest. History might regard his legacy as lasting. Something he said to Studs Terkel might well be his own metaphor. Before I die, I'd like to hear the howl of timber wolves that used to exist here in our woods. His howl is needed more than ever now. So listen to this interview as though you are listening to the thunder of his deep voice in your ear. Even when he spoke quietly, he rumbled like a storm over a nearby hill. And the interview. Studs Terkel. We're in logging country, Napa, Oregon. It is near the mouth of the Columbia River. He's a chunky, muscular man, built along the lines of Hack Wilson, the old Chicago Cubs slugger. He is 62. Enthusiastically, he talks of the vast coniferous forest. You're always aware of the scent of trees if you're a logger. It turns you on. You know you've struck a cedar that may have been buried in the ground for a couple of hundred years. QB, the beauty is going. The old timber that was majestic has been eliminated. In the old days, the Douglas fir was mixed with Sitka spruce, western hemlock, and the great cedars. All through the woods, you found a beautiful mix of trees. Today, trees are planted in predetermined distances apart. It is something to be controlled. The forest, to me, is an awesome and beautiful place. You see this little baby elk that we have in the woods here? Isn't it a beautiful little cuddly thing? But watch that elk grow, and eventually he becomes a magnificent bull with a huge rack of antlers, a deep chest, and proud eyes. He's not cute and cuddly anymore. He is awesome. That's the way it is with trees. You see cute little Christmas trees you'll put on the table. They're immature little things. They have not attained the magnificence that nature puts on these trees at 500 years. They take on character. They're always in a battle. The wind's after them. The lightning's after them. The timber companies don't want a single tree standing anymore. They don't understand that a tree, a snag, is not only a hotel for birds and bats and bees. They are magnificent works of art created by nature and beyond the ability of man to equal. There's a tree down the road here a few miles that's over 10 feet in diameter at the butt. At the very tip top of it is a magnificent crown of jewels, a nest of bald-headed eagles. Timber companies are indifferent to your feelings. I don't think they have any feeling for beauty, for something that is old. The only feeling they want is the tons of pulp to come out of there. Today, when they come to a canyon, they start switchbacking, crisscrossing back and forth with bulldozers, tearing up the ground, silting the creeks, and putting 5 acres of ground out of production per mile of road. Old-time loggers were not able to reach many of the rough places, so these patches and trees were left. The younger loggers were not here to see what was there before. If you've never known something, it's difficult to appreciate what has been lost. I was born and lived here in a logging camp. My dad was a logger. He was a big, raw-boned, powerful man of a very happy nature. I can see him coming home now with his logging clothes on, a rifle in his hand and a deer on his back. The first sounds I can remember are the voices of loggers and the sounds of locomotives and steam donkeys. As a kid, it seemed to me more plentiful of everything. The forests were still virgin. There were fish in the sloughs, lots of waterfowl, and it was a very happy time. No one can grow up here and not be aware of the birds and animals and the river. It gets in your blood, in your thinking, in your way of life. In the old days, when you approached a lumber camp, you began to feel the tempo, the intensity, the turmoil. It was something like a war zone. You could see loggers everywhere, going somewhere, coming back. There were always locomotives moving, backing out, switching. You'd hear the sound of the pop-off valves, of escaping steam, and the smells of crude oil. There was always excitement there. They had the old highball days. You really traveled. One tough old hook tender told a new man, "We don't walk around here. We don't run around here. We fly." There were frequent accidents, broken arms, broken hips, men just killed outright. The camp was a little company town. They had some fellows they called wobblies, organizers. These were IWW, industrial workers of the world, who fought bloody union wars organizing Pacific Northwest logging camps in the early years of the 20th century. They tarred and feathered them up here at Big Creek and made them walk nude down the tracks. My mother remembers that. She was brokenhearted about what they did to those men. Studs Terkel. Who's they? The company men, who were afraid of losing their jobs. They had no protection, so they took it out on the wobblies. Old-timers used to talk about firings. They had 3 crews, one working, one coming from the labor pool, and one going. Work was tough. The methods weren't safe. They were running the men too hard, driving them, working them too long hours and too many days. If the company didn't like you for one reason or another, they fired you. My dad was a union man. Today, all of us loggers belong to the union. My sister still has her union book at home. As a young girl, she was a waitress in the cookhouse. It was a large dining room. They rang the gong, and that was time to eat. The food was good, and they ate heartily. You hardly saw a fat logger in those days. They were all raw-boned. It was very physical. The machinery has taken over so much of that today. I can remember yet the fallers that were falling trees. The saw, not a power saw, made a beautiful swish, 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 a rhythm to it. These men had no shirts on, just down to their wool underwear, each one with a big chew of tobacco in his mouth. One stopped and looked at his partner and said, "Get off and let me ride for a while," meaning he was doing all the work. Each man excelled in his own part. Your value as a faller meant not only how much timber you could put down, but how much you could save. Long before the tree ever came down, you would hear them holler, "Timber!" That call would go down the hill and all through the canyons. The timber is getting so much smaller now. Logging can't be compared to what it was before. Something wild, something beautiful, something free. It's gone. I've been on the hills here and can see so far away, all this logged-off land. It's almost impossible for me to comprehend that mere men destroyed all this timber. Every foot of that ground has been stomped by men. What happened to all that timber? It is one of the few things in the world that boggles my imagination. Sure, some of the animals are dangerous to you. They are after your life. They have crippled many guys and killed people. They're wild in another way now. They're wild from being pursued by people in four-wheel drives, campers. I don't kill anymore. I was very young when I quit. When I'd kill something and watch it die and look at the eyes, I knew I had taken what attracted me in the first place, a life. What did I have but a carcass, and I wasn't hungry. I just quit killing because I took the beauty of the animal, the deer or elk or bear. If it was a duck, I'd want to smooth its feathers when it was dead and stiffened up, that it wouldn't look obscene. The animals aren't wild anymore, just pursued. We've just gone through a cow elk season to thin them out. The forestry department said there were too many, too much damage to young trees. They were killing these elk at a time when it was an absolute disgrace. The vegetation was completely frozen out. The cows, heavy with calves, would bunch up in the timber and lie there very still, conserving their body fat and heat to get through this starving period. Yet the hunters are out there pursuing them. I have a little sanctuary down here, and I'd see big, beautiful honkers coming in. Canadian geese. They're free. I don't pinion them. To pinion a bird is like cutting off the leg of a child to keep it from running around. It turns you off to see them drop, a leg spinning, dangling on a thick piece of skin, shot by hunters. Guns go out there and shoot too many. There's no time to pick them up. They're thrown away. Before I die, I'd like to hear the howl of timber wolves that used to exist here in our woods. We have too damn many hunters and no wolves. We need more cougars, less hunters. Bears are fair game, too. When a bear damages a tree, what he actually does is set that tree to produce more seeds. I've taken 10-foot stumps and found in the very center bear marks that the tree may have received 500 years ago, just as good as they are today. So bears aren't all that bad. We asked the timber company, how many goddamn bears will you allow? I'm a believer that the animals and birds have inherent right to the land. The man can't say, I own this. Everything else off. We had a ruckus with a pack of houndsmen over the killing of bears, killing them left and right. Hounds are worth thousands of dollars, and the houndsmen are really well organized with a powerful lobby. It was a fist fight. Fortunately, I'm able to take care of myself pretty well. I've been threatened. Telephone calls to be killed. It was so tense for a while that I had to carry a pistol. Many times I'm alone in the woods, running a big cat, miles back there. Houndsmen are on these roads. They're all equipped with knives, rifles. It would be the easiest thing in the world to put a bullet through my head over in some canyon. Sometimes people are hesitant to make a move, even though they know it's right. I was walking up this road with a company man. Lo and behold, there were some beautiful big bear tracks. She's in here, an old sow, probably got some cubs. We can't let the houndsmen see her. They have a network. One guy tells another, and down they come with their hounds. This company man, he had about number 10 size shoes, was going up the road, scuffing out the bear tracks. He was protecting the bears when his job said get rid of them. Innermost in many men are subconscious desires they don't allow to surface. I only express my thoughts to people who understand what I'm talking about. Many don't care, don't feel, but there are surprising ones who will help. I got a letter from a man who works for a big lumber company. It says, "You stepped on my toes many times. I'm ready to retire now, and I want to know I'm for you. I don't care to let you know who I am because they'll send me off to Siberia." Many people's voices are stilled because of the position they're in. I happen to be a single man, and it will be pretty hard to starve me, so I can say what the hell I want. When my father died, I quit the woods and took an early retirement. I logged my own place. the chance to live my life out without being a rich man is probably the greatest gift that any person could receive. I have no feeling that I've ever been beaten or that I'm a poor man. I'm rich in many things. I feel I have a responsibility while I'm on this earth to preserve some beauty and pass it on to the next generation. Because if I do not pass something on, these children and their children's children will have a barren world. I believe that only by being in the presence of beauty and the great things in the world around us can man get the goddamn hatred of wanting to kill each other out of his system. We begin to understand that we are only in this world such a short time. It's incredible we should spend these few years hating and killing each other. That was QPZ being interviewed by Studs Terkel. QP was interviewed for a documentary film sponsored by the Clatsop County Historical Society, Steam Whistle Lobby. His interviewer was the late Sam Churchill, also son of a logger and raised in a logging camp, and for a time a logger himself. He was author of a book about his dad, Big Sam, and two other books, Don't Call Me Ma and Say It Again, Sam. He was a World War II Navy veteran and afterward a newspaper columnist. He was also a volunteer programmer for KMUN for several years, primarily hosting a weekly show about early 20th century logging in the Pacific Northwest. QP told Sam, "As I go through the woods now and see the hand-planted timber, I feel like I'm walking through a cemetery. It's a carrot patch." And QP said that when loggers went to town, they fought a lot and they drank a lot. And they spent a lot of time on Astoria's glorious Astor Street where the girls were. I told one fellow once that Astoria went to hell when they took the red lights off the whorehouses down there and put them up on the intersections. Sam Churchill died the year after QP in 1991 at age 80. And Lewis Studs Terkel died at age 96 in 2008. He was like QP, a robust activist against rapacious and predatory policies and practices. He was a writer, actor, historian, and radio broadcaster. He is especially remembered for his oral histories of ordinary Americans and for his radio interviews. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1985. He once said, "I want a language that speaks the truth." Think of what QP said. "I've been on the hills here and can see so far away all this logged-off land. It is impossible for me to comprehend that mere men destroyed all this timber. What happened to all that timber? It's one of the few things in this world that boggles my imagination." Perhaps we might invoke QP's as a ghost when we think of the irreversible worldwide climate change caused by mere human beings, which should boggle all our imaginations. And now, The Price of Fish, which I wrote. A boat or a ship is much like a star moving across the oceans in the same manner as a star through space and time. Its motion seems less from its own volition than the movement of the planet sliding beneath its keel. Points appear or disappear, approach or fade into horizontal haze. Days and nights pass and vanish as quickly as a ship's wake or a gull's cry. They have no meaning, simply a succession of minor cycles, like the rise and fall of tides upon a shore. Memorable only because a few suns passed, a whale might have been sighted, or a storm made a voyage miserable and dangerous for a while. A feeling grows not unlike the ambiguous emptiness sought by Oriental religions, a sense of aimlessness, yet also of great wealth, though nothing is possessed. The movement of the ocean, in tandem with the wind, follows the rhythms of music, and life aboard a deck is a form of dance. The immensity of ocean is difficult to place into human reference. Though we chart it and make neighborhoods of navigation points, plat its surface into abstract grids, these are only thin trails through a vast prairie. it is impossible to not recognize its alienness to us, its antithesis to everything we find familiar and sustaining to our lives ashore. We nestle to the land like gophers in a burrow and feel that it cares for us. Nothing about the ocean gives us that comfort. We can change the land and conform it to ourselves. We can furrow it and plant it. We can build cities and roads. The ocean defies us, refuses to remain still, and rolls past our flimsy ventures on its surface with infinite indifference. We might pollute it and destroy the life that is evolved within it, but we cannot destroy the ocean so completely as we might the land. The ocean is moved only by the wind, sun, and moon, also by the planet's spin. Yet some humans feel about the ocean as they do about their blood. They cherish the aloneness they find on the ocean, an inexplicable paradox of feeling so personally about the implacable insensible. Those who leave shore and sail out onto the ocean become free prisoners held to splinters of wood or metal in a seemingly limitless space, kin to families of seabirds that crowd onto passing logs, related also to fiery trails that cross night skies. They cling to their little boats for more than awareness they cannot walk on water or live long immersed in it. They design their vessels to be solid and seaworthy, familiar perspectives of angles and curves that enclose like wombs, each vessel a seed of human civilization. They might pretend that they are masters of their decks and of the planet, empowered over water and universe, that these are hollow lies amid surging mountains of water that rise and fall with the intensity of lungs and the power to crush boats and men into ocean dust. The presence of death is as close as skin. What the ocean might have seemed to earliest humans is not recorded. Our ancestors must have first approached the ocean as at present we move beyond Earth into space. The first voyages were probably short and timid trips for fish in relatively shallow waters on the lower lips of continents that are rich in sea life. While landsmen experimented with spears and axes for hunting land animals, peoples along ocean shores hollowed out logs and developed paddles and oars for velocity and direction, later sails, and they invented hooks, lines, and nets. Several thousand years later, ocean fishing from boats and decks remains one of the most dangerous methods of food gathering. In clear weather, and most often in foul, fishermen have for centuries gone out into the wild ocean in flimsy cockle shells. Life on fishing boats is hard, lean, and forthright, and the men and women who pull lines or pots or work nets are always close to injury or death. As fishing stocks diminish and regulations become more severe, boats and crews take greater risks that call for intensifying skill and courage. For all its modernization, ocean fishing is a primitive chase of hunter and hunted across a deadly wilderness. Almost everyone who chooses a livelihood on a boat accepts the probability that they will die in the water. Every year, fishing and seafaring communities mourn the loss of friends, neighbors, family members, and shipmates who die at sea. The bodies of some are recovered, but more disappear, and nothing else will be known of them or their vessels. Edward Hellberg and his son, also named Edward, were fishermen. Both men were born and raised in Astoria and spent most of their lives on the decks of boats, and both died at sea. The elder Hellberg was lost with three others of his crew when the shark boat Republic disappeared in a storm in waters off the Columbia River Bar in February 1945. His son died in August 1986 when the large ship suddenly turned into the old and familiar trawler McKinley and cut it in half near Gray's Harbor, a few miles north of where his father's boat sank. The younger Edward Hellberg started fishing when he was a boy sometime after his father's death. He worked on several fishing crews and owned a succession of boats, one of which sank in the Gulf of Mexico. fathers and sons, sometimes mothers and daughters, worked aboard decks with him. He was a man skippers never had to tell what to do. Two of his daughters, who worked as waitresses at a riverside restaurant, always watched for his boat going downriver to the ocean or returning. He waved at them during daylight and flashed a boat light at the restaurant windows at night. When the McKinley was struck, he saved a shipmate from drowning in the forecastle. He died because he was in the cold water too long. His shipmates were younger and less affected by hypothermia and survived. It is not difficult to imagine how they felt, left alone in a cold and dark ocean, abandoned by the ship that ran them down. When the Coast Guard helicopter found them, they had been in the water almost an hour, clinging to a life ring. They scrambled for a wire basket the helicopter dropped, but Eddie could not hold on and fell back into the water. A Coast Guardsman dove into the ocean and retrieved his body. Resuscitation failed to revive him. Many who attended his memorial service in Astoria, which has lost hundreds of its citizens to the ocean and the river, have mourned dead parents, children, friends, and lovers who died with their vessels. And his fellow fishermen, who came to say goodbye, were aware that they might also lose boats and perhaps their lives. After his death, one of his granddaughters, who was 4 years old then, got through the painful ordeal of his loss by imagining she was holding her grandfather's hand. A most important rule of ocean voyages is looking out for other vessels, of keeping a good watch, not only for the protection of one's own craft, but for any that might be in danger. Ships and crews must also respond to the distress of other ships or search the ocean for survivors of sunken vessels. Coastal waters are particularly dangerous because of the large numbers of small craft that are continually run over by large ships that rely ever more on mechanical devices rather than human eyesight. A number of questions about the sinking of the McKinley remain after 34 years. Two are primary: why a good watch was not kept to prevent collision, and why the ship did not stop to rescue or drop a lifeboat to rescue McKinley's crew. The answers will not resurrect the highly regarded McKinley, nor return life to the good and decent man Eddie Hellberg. But on the ocean, and soon in outer space, the human beings who venture out from shore and planet must be responsible for each other, or they will most likely die. And that was The Price of Fish. This is Michael McCusker. The presidential election is exactly 2 months from today, on November 3rd, 2020. This election is not so much about St. Joe and the dragon as it is Biden Wolf versus the monster Grendel. Ensure your vote and your health. Stay safe and smart, and you protect the lives and rights of your family, friends, neighbors, and everyone else. Happy Unlabor Day. The annual silly season has not been so funny this pandemic year.